appreciate your being here with us tonight, Terry. This is really great, and I know this is late and it's past your normal bedtime. You, as I just was saying, that you're a transpersonal therapist, you do mediation, and you teach living compassion, which has to do, I think, with nonviolent communication. Is that correct?
Yes. The classes that I teach actually use two models. I started off with the nonviolent communication model by Marshall Rosenberg a few years ago. I was introduced to it by a friend here in Grass Valley, and so I've been teaching that for a few years. And then a couple of years ago, I was introduced to the book Taking the War Out of Our Words by Sharon Ellison, and it's subtitled Powerful Non-Defensive Communication. So I now use both of those models in my classes.
I want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in talk show. Our number here at the station is 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867, and we'd love to hear from you, I'm sure. Terry would be interested in your questions or comments as we go along through this interview. So if you have any questions as you're listening and would like to give us a call, we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number is 265-9555. Well, Terry, as we've talked about this afternoon, the question we wanted to pose to our listeners regarding this topic is, should communication be less violent? The question that we finally came to was, why do we need violence in our communication? Why do we need violence in our communication? And I think as I discussed that with you, you suggested a sort of an alternative question, which was, what gets in the way of compassionate communication? In a way, it's the other side of the same coin. So I want our listeners, if you're listening and you're interested in this topic, I'd like you to think about that. Why do we need violence in our communication, or what does get in the way of communicating compassionately? Is there an alternative? I think that's the question we're wanting to look at and kind of focus on with Terry tonight. Terry, can you tell us about the whole notion of violence in communication is I think, a good place to start. What is... When we think about violent communication, I mean, what comes to my mind is people yelling at each other, calling each other names, not really listening to what each other is saying, that sort of thing. Am I in the ballpark?
Well, yes. But we also, Marshall Rosenberg calls it also life alienating communication, and that would be anything that really disconnects us from our feelings and needs and from the feelings and needs of the other person. So if we're in our head and we're coming from a place of judgment, interpretation, analysis, and enemy images, those kind of things really alienate us from our natural, compassionate, generous nature.
So life alienating communication rather than...
nonviolent.
Mm-hmm. And so this sounds like we're focusing not simply on how we communicate with each other, but also how we're, in a sense, communicating with ourselves.
Yes.
Does it start there? Is that where it starts?
The way that we talk to ourselves is really, it's really important. When Marshall Rosenberg talks about a particular type of feeling that we have, which is anger, he talks about it as not actually a response to what's happening out there, but a response to our thoughts about what's happening out there. So our thoughts about what's happening are very important in creating our experience.
So could you give an example of that? I think that's a powerfully key point. So if we're in an interaction with a person, you're saying, and Marshall Rosenberg is saying, that how we interpret what we're hearing is really more the key than actually what is being said. Is that true? Is that it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Is there an example of that? Can you think of an example? I think that's... I remember reading this book a little bit. It's been just a little while, and I remember Marshall Rosenberg gave a great example of that. And I'm having difficulty recalling it right at this moment. I don't know if you remember it.
He gave an example one time in a training that I attended with him of being hit in the head with a ball. And if we were playing with children and accidentally got hit in the head with a ball, it would be in a certain context. Versus if we had a thought that somebody hit us on purpose, it could be the same force and the same event of something hitting our head, but our thoughts about the intention of the other person would make a huge difference in our reaction.
That's a great example. I mean, I think I've experienced that and known there have been times when the friend or something in an accidental interaction hurt me, and I knew that it was an accident, and so, you know, my way of taking it or responding was totally different than if it had been intentional.
Right.
You know, Terry, I'd like to jump in. My name is Todd Arvidson, and it's really good talking with you, and I'm really glad you're here on the show tonight. I'm still stuck on the question, why do we need violent communication? I mean, I look at our culture, and I look at the level of violence that's going on, and I think, okay, for our listeners, you know, why do we need violent communication to begin with? I think I see it probably on a daily basis. And I'm kind of curious to take a look at the definition or maybe some, for lack of a better word, why are we so violent in our communication? Why do we need that so much, and why is that so prevalent in our culture? I mean, I'm totally behind you in taking a look at compassion. That's something that I've been looking at personally in the last couple of months. And I'm really glad that we're covering this. But I'm still kind of wondering, wow, why do we need this so much in our culture, and why is it so prevalent?
Well, I think the primary reason that we're violent or life alienating is because we're perceiving a threat. And so being angry, being violent are defensive responses to a perceived threat.
So you're saying that Todd, I think it's a great point, Todd. It seems like it's endemic. It's just a part of the fabric of our culture. This kind of, if you listen to radio, for example, a lot of AM talk radio, what you hear is the Rushes and the Michael Savages and these kind of people who seem to relish and thrive on sort of attacking their listeners or their call-in participants.
Or even Starbucks, you know? Have you been to Starbucks in the last couple of months?
No.
At 12 o'clock noon when everybody wants their coffee? I mean, there's all kinds of there's all kinds of violent communication going on there.
Where people are just driving down the road.
And for me, it's really the better than. I look at it as like, okay, I'm better than you, so I can defend my position in line at Starbucks to get my coffee first, and I'll give you a dirty look or a glare. And go on my merry way and get my latte and be happy. But, you know, I think it's the better than that really is permeating our culture. I'm better than you. I deserve to get there faster. I deserve to get there first. And I think that comes out violent. I think people, you know, you mentioned that there's a perceived threat. And, you know, that's part of my definition of anger is really it's a really visceral response to a perceived or real threat. And why do you think we're so threatened? If we're so violent, that must mean a lot of us are walking around feeling pretty threatened.
One of the people that I brought Sharon Ellison up to Grass Valley last month, and when she was here, she talked a lot in terms of power struggles. And she says that power struggles are pretty much the most pervasive form of addiction in our world, not just in our culture. And that like any addiction, once we get engaged in a power struggle, then there's a kind of the thing that takes over with the adrenaline, the power struggle, where the struggle itself or the power is more important than relationships, and we're not actually really connected to our own selves and our own humanity anymore.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me.
So it's really about winning.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And protecting yourself at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
And it is visceral. I think that's a good word, because I think it is almost like we go when that happens, and I can relate to that. I know that's been an issue in my life of getting reactively angry and feeling very threatened or defeated or just a powerful sense of loss that triggers a kind of fight or flight reaction, and it can take the form of either withdrawing and just totally disconnecting. Or reacting angrily.
Yeah.
And so
how many guys out there feel more powerful when they're angry? That's what I want to know. Or women. I mean, men or women. It's like, okay, I love compassion, and I do want to get to that later on tonight. But I think anger and rage are a lot more powerful than compassion, at least up front and visibly.
Yeah, I'm interested in your thought about that, Terry.
Well, I think that most of us would do almost anything not to feel powerless or vulnerable or weak.
Yeah.
And in our culture, we think of open-hearted often or vulnerable as being weak. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And you're saying we'll do anything not to feel weak or vulnerable.
Or powerless.
Or powerless. Well, is vulnerable really equated with powerless, though?
Well, I don't think it is in reality. I think that there's tremendous power in allowing yourself to be vulnerable. But I think culturally we're conditioned the other way.
Hmm. The other thing that I'm looking back at your example of the guy or the girl, the person that gets hit in the head playing with a kid. Some people go, oh, it's little, you know, Johnny or Susie, they threw the ball, how cute, ha, I've got a little bump on my head. But I've also been, you know, I've witnessed people totally going off, on something that wasn't, you know, a threat to them. They totally went off and they perceived it as a threat, and pretty soon they're defending themselves at all costs.
And well, I've experienced that myself.
Yeah.
I've gotten an email from somebody, and for some reason it just really triggered me the wrong way, and my blood pressure can go up in an instant, and I feel that adrenaline and whatever else raging through my body. And what I've really learned from nonviolent communication model is to take a pause and to look at what am I thinking that's triggered that.
Yeah. Well, the average neural firing lasts about 7 seconds. So what I know is that it takes the count to 10 theory works, gives yourself a time, it gives your brain chemistry time to settle down and get into a less fight or flight mode. I know that. I'm still curious to know more about why is our culture so wired to respond this way?
Well, I think we're getting fear-based messages in the media all the time.
Yeah, did you see it was in the editorial about this guy writing about the weather for the union? Did you see that? It was about 4 months ago.
No.
He wrote the editors of the union and said, please don't use the words threat of rain shower.
Wow.
I mean, how is really a rain shower a threat? I mean,
wow.
You know, and they responded back. The union responded back and said, you know, point well taken. We're not going to be using threat of a rain shower any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I agree. I think that's important.
Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to the Men's Talk Show here on KVMR. And our guest this evening is Terry Harmon. Terry teaches compassionate communication, and we're talking with her tonight about nonviolent communication. Terry, as you said, you brought Sharon Ellison to the Miners Foundry a couple of weeks ago. I was there that evening, and it was very well attended presentation, very, very interesting. And you're saying that Sharon's saying that this issue of power struggle is sort of endemic or epidemic in our society and the way people communicate, and that it's we get all caught up in avoiding feeling vulnerable or powerless at all cost.
Well, and I also was thinking about that in response to the question about feeling better than.
Mm-hmm.
Better than is a judgment about our status compared to somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to perceive ourselves as powerful. And the way that we're conditioned to do that is to win, to be better than, to compete.
Exactly. So as you're talking about this and you're saying in your own personal life, if you encounter someone, you get an email that pushes a button and you are triggered by that, your way of dealing with that is to stop and ask yourself to look at your what you're thinking, what's going on in your mind, how you're interpreting,
yeah,
what's being communicated to you, as a way of stepping out of that kind of reactive, violent, or potentially violent mode.
And one of the things that I've learned, a trick for myself, sometimes I can get into these judgmental loops where I'm just, you know, on and on and on in my mind, I'm after somebody, you know, almost like in an obsessive way. I'm just
judging them, and they're wrong, and they shouldn't do this, and I just, you know, maybe wake up in the middle of the night, or I drive down the road, and all of a sudden I'm cussing this person out again.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that. I spend a lot of time in my life really wanting to get connected to a heart place, and then when I find myself in that really angry, judgmental place again, it's painful for me. And one way that I've learned how to get out of that is to stop the judging and just get into my feelings and just acknowledge to myself, I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times in our culture, at least I know I was conditioned to not say I don't like things or I want this or I want that. But we talk in terms of that's a good idea, that's not a good idea. So we pretend that we're rational in what we like, and we're actually confusing our value judgments with our moral judgments. So if we don't like something and it doesn't match our values, then we make a moral judgment and say that it's wrong. And that's when we get into that mind-tripping judgment place.
Which tends to polarize everything.
Exactly.
So do you think that, did you watch the debate?
I did.
Did you think that was a demonstration of violent communication or a demonstration of nonviolent communication?
Well, I didn't see much nonviolent communication happening there.
How would you characterize? I'm interested in your perceptions of that, because it's probably a lot of our listeners listened to or watched the debate and thought about it. And how did you see it as violent communication?
Well, one of the reasons I really enjoyed reading Sharon Ellison's book, Taking the War Out of Our Words, is because it actually labels many different types of ways that we use our language defensively.
Hmm.
And when I read her book and started seeing a list of these things, I started actually understanding why my gut gets twisted just watching the news.
Hmm.
And one of the things, she talks about three different ways that we use language in a warlike way. One is the way we ask questions. If we ask questions in a way that we're actually not wanting information, but we're wanting to give someone our agenda or shame, like, why did you really do that? It's not a question about wanting information, why did you do that, but it's an attack.
Mm.
So the way we use questions are often attacking and interrogating, and will cause a defensive response. Another way that we misuse language or use it defensively is the way we use statements when we say, this is true, and what we're speaking of is our own experience or our own subjective belief or opinion, and we're stating it as fact. I saw a lot of that happening Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way it is.
And it's in that the implication is that I'm right and you're wrong.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that, would you say, is that an essential aspect or feature of violent communication, making oneself right and the other person wrong?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's really clear for me. I really see that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's what's fascinating for me listening to this is I'm just aware myself of this process of, you know, how do we evaluate ourselves? How do we know whether we're okay or not? And there is this issue for me around, you know, looking at measuring success in terms of that better than issue. And I think it's really true. I think our society really promotes that. And there's a part of my being, my part of who I am that knows that that's bogus or superficial. It's one way of looking at things, but I know it's not the deepest or the wisest or the truest way of looking at things.
For me, I have a different idea about the better than. I think the better than is a wound, or it's certainly a defensive response, and it comes from the wound of recognition. In other words, I need to be recognized, I need to be valued, I need to be esteemed, I need to be important.
Mm.
And for me, the first piece in working through that is going, hey, I've got this wound, and you know, I didn't get some recognition, and I'll do some really crazy, sneaky things to get it, like, you know, if somebody's cutting you off or somebody's needs to get on the freeway, you know, instead of speeding up and taking your spot or my spot on the freeway because it's mine, going, wow, that's really, I don't need to, you know, deal with that wound that way.
I think that's a powerful point. Do you have a thought about that, Terry?
Well, one of the things, again, that I love about Marshall Rosenberg's book is he talks about feelings and needs. And we all have needs for being of value, being heard, being seen, safety, beauty, harmony. And he says that judgments and violence are a tragic expression of unmet needs.
I think it's a kind of a different way of saying what Todd said. I think they're very similar points of view.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that as men, I think what I mean is this being a men's talk show, and I think we're looking at what is it about men that may be different than women, or that we as men want to understand and learn to be able to live more effectively and happily. What is it, what happens in us that makes it so difficult for us to recognize those feelings and underlying needs and be able to speak to those in a direct kind of way? I mean, I think, what you're saying is it really does make sense. And I know that this being when I'm able to speak from that place of I'm needing this and I'm clear about that, it does really clarify things hugely. And sometimes it's very difficult to get to that place of saying honestly what I'm really needing.
Yeah. I totally hear that, and I'm sort of thinking here. At some point that Sharon Olson probably talks about a continuum of violence in her book. I haven't read the book. I'm really interested in picking up a copy. Anything from a dirty look to hands-on and physical abuse and things like that. In your experience, Terry, what's the most common? Like, if you had to choose, somewhere in between that continuum, what do you find yourself dealing with on a daily basis or, in your work with individuals or?
I had a conversation earlier this week with Mike, and we were talking about how are men more violent than women. And my response at the time, and I'm still thinking about it, is that I think we can be just as violent with our use of shame, guilt and manipulation as with physically hitting somebody. I mean, I don't go for either one.
Sure.
But I know I can be just as hurt or go just as nuts if someone's doing a guilt trip with me or kind of like killing me with niceness. You have to be nice, you have to be polite, just totally not allowing my vital force and expression and passion. I think that's very, very violent.
Yeah.
Telling us to be good little girls.
Yeah. It's a way of objectifying who, if that's how we're relating to a person with those kinds of expectations, we're really objectifying them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had experiences where I just felt like somebody actually could kill me with a look.
Mm-hmm.
Just I can feel that judgment and total, invalidation, and I suddenly feel 2 inches tall.
Absolutely.
Even seeing the spinning lights behind you in your rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
that doesn't feel too good. Doesn't feel like a compassionate response.
Yikes. Scary. Well, I just want to remind our listeners again, you're listening to the Men's Talk Show here on KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City. Our guest this evening is Terry Harmon. Terry teaches classes on living compassion. She has a website. Terry, can I share that?
Yes, please.
www.livingcompassion.com, and she can be reached at 432-8302 if you're interested in learning more about her classes or her work with this topic. Really appreciate your being here again. I want to remind the listeners our phone number is 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867 if you'd like to call in. What do you think, if you're listening, do you have a thought about violence in our communication? Do we need violence in our communication? What gets in the way for you of communicating more compassionately? I think our world is full of the effects of violent communication. I think it's fascinating, Terry, the way you're explaining. Oftentimes, the way we react, if we react in violence, it's because of the thoughts that we're having, the interpretation that we're giving to what the other person is saying or even doing. I mean, it could be that we've been struck and physically hurt But if it's clear in our mind, our thought is that was an accident, or there's some underlying cause for what just happened other than just malice or an intent to intimidate and harm, then that really does change the way we tend to see it and think about it and then in turn respond. And so it's a powerful subject, and it's very, I think this to me is very helpful because it really does clarify an issue that I've struggled with in my own life, and I think a lot of men and women have. And I think it's so subtle that it's difficult to really begin to conceptualize it clearly. And I think what you're describing, Terry, and the work of Marshall Rosenberg and Sharon Ellison, both of them in different ways, I think, are really groundbreaking and very helpful.
They've been enormously helpful for me in being able to get more clear in my thinking and more clear about what it is I am wanting, more clear about what it is I am reacting to. I've done years and years in the corporate world of effective communication and coaching and, you know, lots of training, including a graduate degree in transpersonal psychology. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I came in contact with these models. These have really taken me to, like, a whole new level of being able to get clear, being able to forgive, being able to understand. It's hard to understand somebody else and their point of view and walk in their moccasins if we're really involved in our own reactive place. I know when 9/11 happened, I gathered with a group of people to do some meditation and prayer, and one of the things that we did was look at what was happening as people, you know, doing their best to meet their needs. Not that we like it at all. We absolutely disagree with their strategies for meeting their needs, but in able to keep it like we're relating to people on a human, these are human beings. If we can understand at least that they're trying to meet needs, what kind of needs are they trying to meet, and how can we start talking to them like with Aikido, you know, how do you align with somebody so you can look in the same direction and see actually what we both want is, you know, safety and, you know, to be valued, but we just have really different ways of getting there.
So you're saying the question in the response to 9/11 that you went through with your friends and the praying and all of that, that you were asking yourself, what are the underlying needs of the terrorists, and what's really that all about?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's to me, that's one of the huge questions that hasn't even begun to be addressed in the political, you know, in any of the political views. Although I guess not any. I think there it has been in some, but in the major parties it hasn't. In the debates, I don't think it has. That there is just, it's just a knee-jerk kind of we're right and you're wrong, and there's no discussion of what might be behind this behavior on the part of the terrorists. Why would they want to strike us in this really profoundly horrible and tragic way?
Right.
Wait, Terry, we got a caller here. Just a sec. Can you hang on just one moment? Hi, caller. You're live on KVMR with our guest tonight, Terry Harmon. Who's this? Barry, thanks for calling. Can you speak
Bernie,
up to
Bernie?
Bernie, thanks. Where are you calling from, Bernie?
Grass Valley.
Appreciate your calling. Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, I just really got interested at this moment when you were talking, because this show is more interesting than almost anything I've heard in a long time. I didn't have anything to say. I was so interested. I just want to compliment the evening so far.
Oh, appreciate that very much.
Because I'm involved with things like that. In fact, I was school teacher where there was a Buddhist abbot from I knew this fellow that teaches about compassion at the California Institute of Asian Studies, San Francisco. We were kind of friends, and most of the time he talked about a course called emptiness, which people did have anger inside of them, thought he wasn't teaching anything, and they tried to get rid of him at the college. And I stood up for him because he was really talking about compassion, because he was talking in terms of a Buddhist situation where you have to rise above it, then The real thing has to be that you, when somebody does something, you do have to do like this lady said. You have to take a pause, and then you have to think good thoughts about the person, and they really don't mean, you know, what they're saying in a mean way. And it really boils down to the fact that you brought up these terrorists. That, you know, they're terrorists only because they've been put into these terrible false belief systems. I am a teacher of Middle Eastern studies, and I know that the teachings of the founder of Islam were compassionate teachings, and that the people who are these leaders of religion in the Middle East, these Muslim leaders and the teachers, have really gone wrong. And I know a lot about it. I'm a member of the Baha'i, which is a very peaceful organization that is persecuted by the Iranian government. And I know that there's some real big problems, and they all boil down to not just the family, although in my case, I know that the problems that I had was from a very difficult family situation. And I did experience divorce and things like that. It was the fact that no matter what happened to me, I really have a love for humanity as I'm feelings for other people. And so I get along very well with these Buddhist people that have come over here, and they're very high-ranking people who have given up their bishopric or, you know, their status within their Oriental community to perform a service for us here in this part of the country. So I didn't know about Mr. Rosenberg, and that sounds very good, too. And I don't think I want to take up any more time except to just say that I really enjoyed the program, and there's so much to talk about. Anyhow, the final thing would be simply that the terrorists thought that they were really good people. And they were, in a certain way. They were just misled. Because if you remember the guy on TV, you know, they showed the leader of the group of terrorists. My goodness, he was really a spiritual person thinking he was doing the right thing. But if you know life today, if he would have understood where we are now in this time in history, he would never have done a thing like that. And there's plenty of moderates in that part of the world. And I hope that we never condemn the whole society, because there's a billion people in the world who are Mohammedans, and they all believe in Jesus, and the Christians never seem to know about it. And they're trying to convert the Mohammedans, and there's all kinds of problems. But the worst one is within the group. It's this hypocrisy of their leaders. So I'm not against President Bush for going into Iraq, because something did happen out of it. Last thing I'd like to say is that now that there's religious freedom there, they're not killing Baha'is or Jews anymore. They can't get away with that, but they're still killing Baha'is and Jews in Iraq. That's a problem still. And you have to look at those people there, the government people who are so-called religious people. They might as well be part of the Spanish Inquisition. Nice talking to you. I really enjoyed the program.
Bernie, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
You know, Terry, I was listening to Bernie, and I was just kind of thinking in my mind about, can we, as a society, can we really keep up with the media? Can we? I mean, I love your message about compassion, teaching context and communication, and teaching to stay in relationship. That's kind of what I hear you saying. But can we, as a community, or as clinicians, or as people of spiritual faith, can we really keep up with the media and what it's doing to our, you know, what I think is going on in our youth culture today? I watched, you know, about 4 months ago, I watched for the first time about 10 minutes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I could not believe how I was really shocked at how one of the vampire guys, he's probably a teenager, is totally beating this girl in an alley. And I'm thinking, this is what our culture's really into.
You're reminding me of a chapter that I reread recently, written by Joanna Macy, who talks about doing despair work as part of our social change efforts. and that it's really important that we get in touch and allow ourselves to feel the grief about what we've lost and the despair that we do feel about that we can't continue as a species and a planet the way that we're going. And she said that what's happening in with our movies, and there are so many movies of mass destruction, is that it's our attempt to kind of pretend that we're dealing with the issues through watching the movies in a way that we're not actually able to really deal with in our real lives.
I think that's a profound thought.
Yeah. I've been reading about juvenile crime the last couple of months, and what I've been reading is that the highest rise in juvenile crime has been among adolescent females in the last year. They're having to build new adolescent prisons for females. They can't keep up with the amount of arrests and convictions and incarcerations of female adolescents. I'm thinking, wow, that seemed to happen overnight. When did the females catch the guys? Because, typically most men are in prison. I mean, one out of four African-American men are in prison today.
You're saying that the ratio is much higher men to women that are incarcerated.
Well, right now
have been
the adolescents. Yeah. I mean, the female adolescent population is really, when I was in Illinois, that's what they were scrambling to try and figure out. How are they going to manage this problem? And it's really violence. We have a caller.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry to hang on, Terry. Hi, caller. You're live on KVMR with our guest tonight, Terry Harmon. Who's this?
Oh, hi, this is John. I'm calling from Sacramento.
Hey, great, John. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a really interesting subject tonight, and I wanted to call in and share some thoughts, and also I would like to get your guest, her reaction to a couple things. I'm in the transpersonal field myself, so I have some thoughts about that are kind of related to transpersonal work.
Great.
My thought is, when you guys were talking earlier about, let me gather my thoughts here. When you're talking earlier about how people perceive a threat and they're reacting, they become violent because they're perceiving a threat from someone else or something outside themselves, right?
Yes.
So my own understanding of Jungian work and Jungian psychology, and what's also called depth psychology, is that, and my thought about it, connected to the idea of perceived threat, is that, we think of, we perceive something outside of ourselves as a threat, but my point is that it's really a projection, and I would like your guest comment on that. But what I mean by that is that well, we all have the capacity to be violent, okay? But if we don't accept that, if we don't own that part of ourselves, then we will tend to project it outwards, and that can appear as a perceived threat from someone else.
What you're talking about is you're talking about abdicating our own power or authority or strength or weakness onto somebody else and then perceiving that as a threat. Is that what you're saying? I mean, that's what I have it.
Yeah, but I'm saying something more clearly in that the capacity to be violent, we all have that. You look at all the myths and all the great movies, even The Lord of the Rings, everyone has their dark side. And
certainly,
within that dark side is the capacity to be violent.
One
in our communication,
favorite poems,
in our behavior.
Oh, yes, please, go ahead, Terry.
One of my favorite poems is by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's called Call Me By My True Name.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's saying is, I am the rapist, and I am the girl who was raped.
Mm. Wow, that's incredible.
Call me by my true name so that I may know all my joys and all my sorrows, that they may open the door of compassion.
Mm. Oh, that's just incredible.
Who's that by?
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm. So are you guys, am I making my point clear?
Well, let's, Terry, did you understand?
Like to hear,
yes.
I would like to hear Terry's, her thoughts about that, if she thinks that's a valid concept. And if that's, if that is what essentially is happening with a lot of people, that they're just projecting, they're not owning their own, potential or capacity to be violent. They're projecting it.
Violent instinct, yeah.
Well, that's why I'm saying I love this poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, is because I'm recognizing that I am all parts. I am violent as well as compassion. I have both of those parts within me, and if I can do my part to own that and accept it within myself, I'll be much less likely to be projecting it out, those disowned parts of myself.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're really agreeing with the point that John's making.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I'm saying, too. That's what I feel about it intuitively.
But I'd like to say something else. When I was reading Marshall Rosenberg's book, and he's talking about how we label our feelings and our needs, I got a huge aha. And I'm someone who had already done years and years of therapy and graduate school in counseling. I was still saying things like, I feel invalidated, I feel threatened, I feel manipulated. And the way that I was languaging my feelings was keeping me stuck in victim consciousness.
Yeah.
So say a little bit more about that, Terry. That seems profoundly important. So identifying the feeling, or how we label and identify the feeling, can be critical.
So the feelings behind being invalidated are really what?
They're judgments or interpretations about what the other person is doing to us.
So they're really judgments, not feelings.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how would Marshall, John, are you okay with this?
I'm listening. Go ahead.
All right. So how does he suggest, it's simply a matter of recognizing that what we're telling ourselves is that what we're feeling are not feelings, they're judgments, and that we need to look more clearly at what the real feelings are.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, so how would you, could you give us an example of how that might look? Rather than the judgments, where would the feelings be in that?
So let's say a friend of mine doesn't return my call, and I think, well, she doesn't respect me, so I feel disrespected. If I language it that way, I'm upset with my friend, and when she calls, I'm probably going to have a reactive, defensive conversation.
Mm-hmm.
If instead I could say, I feel hurt, I feel disappointed, I feel sad, because what I'm really wanting is connection and respect, and a strategy for meeting that need would be, could you please return my phone call within 24 hours? That the way that we language it is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Versus just jumping in and judging and saying, really, criticizing somebody, you are disrespecting me. Mm-hmm. That's one of those making our opinion or our judgment into truth when it's not.
Yes.
I like that example. It reminds me of, walking into a room and saying, what's your problem?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's really... it goes back to John's point. That's a total projection.
Right.
And it's also... I think that what I'm really interested in talking about further is that, behind a lot of anger there's fear.
Yes.
And you were talking earlier about how, we're a fear-based society and we're there's threat, we're being threatened all the time, and there's the newest threat to the crops, and I mean how do you use compassion in all that? How can you use compassion to go, okay, you know what? I've got all this fear going on. I've identified that. So what would be the next step for compassion?
Well, I really like the idea of Joanna Macy's and Marshall Rosenberg that we need to do our despair work.
Mm-hmm.
And that despair work can be very, it can be very hard for us to face powerlessness and our fear of loss of control and that sort of thing. I have to work actually not to go into overwhelm. I have to watch how much news I watch.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do things that keep me grounded and, manage my hope for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't keep falling into that, pit of despair, and then I go, well, what does it matter? Back to your earlier question about what's happening with adolescent girls, I remember even when I was a teenager in the 70s, feeling like, well, what does it matter? The Vietnam War and all of that. What does it matter? Nothing we do makes a difference. And when we're coming from that hopeless place, it's real hard to act compassionately and responsibly.
Here's a great poem. I love the one by Thich Nhat Hanh. There's one by Machado that I love that speaks to this, in which he says, and it's a translation from Spanish, so it's kind of awkward, but he says, part of the poem says, Last night when I was sleeping, I dreamt, oh, marvelous error, that there was a spring in my heart, and I asked myself from what secret aqueduct flows this water of a new life that I have never drunk before. Last night when I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous error, that there was a beehive in my heart, and the golden bees were making white combs and sweet honey of my old failures.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm. I love that.
It's like it's reminding us that beneath this, the drama of all this story and fear and all the stuff that sells news time and all the stuff in our society, beneath that is this, you know, this immense universe of compassion and acceptance and openness. And it's what we find, I think, when we do go into forgiveness, or we do go into really asking those questions that, Terry, you're talking about, asking ourselves, you know, what am I thinking? What's the thought that I'm holding? And understanding that the thought is what's really creating the impulse, or the, you know, to strike back or to react violently out of a desperate need to maintain a sense of importance.
So when I saw that Buffy, you know, the 10 or 15 minutes of Buffy, I was angry.
Mm.
I had no compassion for whatever station that is. I think it's the WB, if I'm correct. I had no compassion for them. Yeah. I was angry. I'm like, what are you promoting? What are you teaching men in our culture, that it's okay to hit a woman and literally, from the vampire's perspective, treat her like a piece of meat? I was appalled.
Yeah.
And had I had a media executive in my house at that time, I don't think I would have been very compassionate. I have two young daughters. I'm like, I don't want you believing that that's what you deserve from another person. Mm-hmm. And so, as we're sitting here, I'm getting more angry about the media. Like, you know, it's very frustrating. I'm thinking, okay, there's no way, at least tonight, that I could have any compassion for what's going on in the media today. I just don't. Yeah. Maybe I'll get there one of these days. But
you know, can I do this? I really like to give Terry a chance to respond to that and to see what her suggestion for you might be. But I don't want to forget that we do have John on the line with us. And John, I don't want to ignore you too long. Is there anything else that you wanted to say or to contribute to this?
Oh, no, it's been a great conversation. I have one other thing, you know, I want you to continue with your present, you know, topic.
Sure.
Whatever. It's maybe you can bring it up later, but it's just a thought that, because you guys mentioned at the beginning of the program about communication, about, you know, why is there so much violent communication? And I'm just wondering if it's the reason because our society, you know, because we don't know how to express it in positive ways, but also, you know, we call ourselves civilized, and we've moved maybe from expressing it in less physical ways, but now we're using, you know, the verbal, you know, we're communicating our anger verbally because we don't have any other tools. So, you know, that's my final thought.
John, that's the old argument of why should they stop fighting in hockey? I mean, that's that argument right there.
Why
should they stop fighting in hockey? I mean,
there's
a pro fight and an against fight in the world of hockey, and a lot of people think if you take fighting out of hockey, people aren't going to show up for it.
The people enjoy or are kind of hooked on the adrenaline rush that they get from watching other people, like football games, get. You get to, you just, there is a real energy rush behind that. You go into a fight or flight mode. You identify with the guy who's making the shot or getting creamed or whatever it is, and you're all pumped up. And after the game is over, you have to go for a walk around the block, right, there, something.
I've never identified with a guy that got his butt kicked, that's for sure.
So you can do it on a hockey.
You feel sympathetic a little bit. You know?
Yeah, so that's a good point. You can do it on a hockey, you call it a hockey field?
Rink.
Hockey rink. You can do it on the rink, see, but you can't do it in public because then it becomes assault or whatever.
Right.
And so my point is that, you know, we call ourselves more civilized, and that's, I question that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Anyways, my point is that we're being less outward with our violence, and so we're being more subtle with it by using it in a verbal way.
Mm.
Yeah.
John, thanks so much for making that point on the Men's Talk Show and for giving us a call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. I'm really enjoying the topic tonight.
Great. We'll be back
in
2 weeks.
I want to thank your guest, too.
Terry, can I come back to you and ask you if you have a thought about Todd's question there, or his Todd's saying, I'm feeling really angry and frustrated with the TV network running this Buffy show. And is there any thought you have? And how would you suggest that he look at that from taking that to a into a nonviolent or compassionate place with himself so that he could do something constructive with it?
That's a really good question.
My belief is that I would get further on my anger with the media. I would get further on. I mean, I emailed Carl's Jr. because they're using Hugh Hefner as a spokesperson. You know, I got angry and said, "What are you doing using Hugh Hefner?" You know, I emailed, and anyway, that's sort of the same point. But
Terry, do you have a thought?
Well, it's a good question. I can definitely find my own places of anger and places where it's hard and challenging for me to come back to an understanding and compassionate place.
It continues to amaze me. I have a thought. If you're collecting your thoughts, I can jump in for a sec. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
I was just thinking, it continues to amaze me how, there's a saying, I forget exactly how it goes, but it's how one person revealing their truth in innocence and openness oftentimes humbles everyone. When you hear a person speak from that place, that deep place of truth, that sometimes to me, and I've had that experience in meetings and groups of people where one person will open up and speak from a place of utter vulnerability about what they're feeling and what they're thinking, and there's such clarity and lucidity in it that everything else pales. And oftentimes it's not the person who was speaking with the most vehemence. It's actually the person coming from the place of greatest vulnerability. And I'm thinking with that, I mean, if you go into your anger and, you know, your thoughts and process it, like Terry's talking about with the Marshall Rosenbergs, what am I feeling, what am I needing, what is my request, that in fact might have, great power. I oftentimes get stuck with the anger and the frustration and then just kind of go into resignation because I can't get clear enough with what exactly I'm feeling and what exactly I'm needing. So it's very helpful, I think, to do that.
What I'm thinking of as you were talking is that what I need to do when I can remember to do it is to stop and connect with myself. And often, again, there's that need to mourn and need to grieve. I am very, very sad that this is happening. I think often underneath that kind of anger, there is a deep, deep sadness. And if we can just acknowledge that and do our grief work and connect again with ourselves, our joy, our humanity, our spirituality, whatever it is that we can connect with, then we can focus on where is it we're wanting to go and acting out of that more positive place. Mm-hmm. We had the director of the Bay Area NVC group here earlier this week to meet with some of us in the community, and when I was speaking with her one-on-one about sometimes how hard it is for me when people keep going to that negative place and get stuck in their story, she said what she's learned how to do is stay in the dream instead of in the nightmare.
That's a great thought. Terry, can we just hold that thought? We're at the top of the hour here and need to identify the station, and we need to play a promotional piece here. Can you hang on with us for a little while longer, or do you need to check? We talked about an hour, and I know it's late. How are you feeling?
I'm enjoying the conversation. I'd be happy to hang on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thanks so much. I need to play this promotional piece, and you're listening to the Men's Talk Show here tonight on KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City. And our guest is Terry Harmon. Terry is a transpersonal therapist and does a lot of work and workshops and trainings in the area of nonviolent communication, living compassion, and she can be reached at www.livingcompassion.com. We'll be back shortly. I'm just going to play this piece, and we'll be back in just a few minutes to continue this conversation. Well, we're back here live at KVMR tonight, 89.5 FM in Nevada City. You're listening to the Men's Talk Show, and our guest tonight is Terry Harmon. We're talking about nonviolent communication. Questions we're looking at is, do we need violence in our communication? How does violence serve us? Or what gets, and what the other side of that is, what gets in the way of compassionate communication? And Terry, we really appreciate your being here and being willing to stay with us for a bit longer. I was just talking with Todd for a second during the break there, and he was Todd, do you want to talk a little bit more? We were talking about his reaction to that TV program and to the violence that was being portrayed there.
Well, I think, I mean, Terry, you'd mentioned to kind of sit with the real feelings behind the anger. I mean, the feelings are fear. And you know, the fear is that, wow, you know, my girls are going to be raised in a culture of violence. And, you know, the last thing I want them to be is to be raised with the other gender believing, hey, I can just go around and treat, you know, women any way I want. And I was sad. And I am, I really, being a male, I'm very aware of the gender shame that I have about, you know, being a male, because men aren't portrayed in the media as very compassionate, very caring, smart, articulate. I mean, you look at the major celebrities on TV at this point, how many smart, compassionate, articulate men are on sitcoms? Can you name one? Captain Kirk, you know, or
Homer Simpson.
Homer Simpson. And so it really, I mean, it's twofold. One, I feel a lot of sadness about how men are being portrayed in that show. And I also feel some fear about, okay, based on how they're being portrayed, it's going to show up maybe in my kid's life later on. I don't know. So, I mean, I can understand that. I can really go there. And I also am probably at this point more aware of, okay, here's another guy show where we're, you know, abusing women. And I feel sad about that. I really do. And I want something different for our culture, our gender. And that's why I think this topic is so important tonight.
And I would really want to encourage you to think about making a request of the station or the people who are promoting that stuff that's offending you. Or, I mean, I think that's the third part. Isn't that the third piece, Terry? The part, feelings, needs, and requests. The third piece being, what's my request? What do I need? I mean, what can I do about this need? How can I empower myself?
Right. That's making requests from a non-judgmental place is really important. And I also really like the pieces of Sharon Ellison's model of powerful non-defensive communication, where we can ask people non-defensive questions like, do you think that that's real entertainment?
Mm.
You know, we need to work on how we're stating it so that it's hopefully not perceived in a defensive way. But in addition to making requests, we can ask non-defensive questions in a way that will help the other person reflect and take responsibility for their actions.
That's a great skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, you. I think, Todd, you communicate. You impress me with your thoughtful, compassionate communication. I mean, you know, my knowing of you, you really do a good job with that.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know. I think I would. I don't know that the stations, the TV stations, are going to be particularly receptive. But
no.
It's a good question.
Good place to start.
Well, Terry, one of the questions I have is about these two. I mean, they're two really important works. I've read most of Marshall Rosenberg's book, and I've started Sharon Ellison's book, and I was very impressed by both of them. How could you? I'm sort of interested in how you might characterize the differences or the overlap and the differences in those two.
Well, both models really encourage us to take responsibility for our own feelings and needs and our own experience. So that's really important, so that we're not putting the blame on other people for how we feel or what we're experiencing. So I think that that's an important component of both of them. The nonviolent communication model focuses more on being really clear about how we're languaging the difference between observations and judgments, real clear about identifying our judgments, and then how we label our feelings, needs, and requests. Whereas the powerful non-defensive model takes a lot more focus on the defensiveness part and the power struggle part. And so, in the non-defensive model, she talks about being really clear about when we're asking questions, are we asking for information, how we make statements. And the piece in the non-defensive model that's different is setting predictions or consequences. Both models are very much not in favor of punishment. In the non-violent communication model, they talk about being clear if we're making a demand of someone, then their choice, they have three choices. They can submit, They can rebel, or they can translate it and come from their own internally motivated place. But let's be clear about when are we making a demand? And it's a demand if we're going to punish somebody if they don't do what we want. There's a really wonderful book that I'm reading by Alfie Kohn, K-O-H-N, called Punished by Rewards. The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes. And he talks about how our culture has gone way off the deep end with this behavior modification, controlling people's behavior by rewarding them. And that actually what we find is that rewards are counterproductive. They've done studies after studies that are listed in this book where they show that if you take, let's say, an engineering or creative problem to college students and you ask them to solve it, if you tell them that you're going to reward them for their efforts, they will be less creative and they will take more time.
That's fascinating.
So, and it happens with our children too. If we reward our children for playing with, let's say math games, in the short run they might increase their playing with math games, but the minute you withdraw the reward, they quit playing, they play with them even less than they would have on their own natural inclination. So when we reward somebody or punish somebody, we change their own internal motivation, and they're not bringing their own resources anymore. They're performing for an external authority or judge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That is profound. It's Alfie Kohn. I love that. I struggle with this, and I think it's so much an issue in our culture and our society, this pursuing, a career for monetary, to make a living, for money, and the struggle between, finding our own internal motivation, as you're saying, versus the external, the carrot. And that is really, I think that's so clear, the way you just described that. It's fascinating.
He's also written a book called The Schools Our Children Deserve,
mm-hmm.
and another book called No Contest, which really goes back to what we were talking about earlier, this winning and losing and competition place.
Mm-hmm.
It's the case against competition. When we play win-lose, we actually really all lose.
Well, it's so much a part of what's going on in the world these days. I think the models that are being promoted and some of the problems that the models themselves seem to create. And Todd and I may have different ways of looking and thinking about that, but that's my belief.
Yeah.
That I think that we sometimes create many more problems than we solve with by the very manner in which we approach the problem.
Yes.
Actually, I totally agree with you that internal rewards are much more effective than external rewards, and they're a lot more powerful, and they teach self-reliance and resiliency. And I work with adolescents for 13 years, and certainly watching the internal rewards be a lot stronger than the external rewards in the long run.
We've got another caller here. Hi, caller. You're live on KVMR. Who's this?
Hi. My name is Bonnie. I'd like to ask...
Bonnie, where are you calling from?
Downs Valley.
Oh, great. Oh,
yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Terry if they're working on this, discovering that competition isn't helpful. Are they coming up with ideas of, how to replace that? Because this culture is just so obsessed with competition, and I dealt with that with my kids growing up, seeing that it didn't seem to make sense to me, but then what replaces it in this culture? And I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Terry, you have a thought?
Well, actually, I have a thought tied to one I was thinking of earlier. I heard a taped lecture by Rollo May, who spoke at Esalen back in the 70s, and I heard the tape a few years ago, and it was about spirituality and violence.
Mm.
And he was saying that we have a need to be connected to something larger than ourselves.
Mm.
And so in our culture, when we've gotten out of touch with things like community, vision quest, rites of passage, there were a lot of things that gave us meaning. And we've replaced them with, football games and win-lose kind of games. And we really are hungering for our lives to have meaning and to be a part of something larger than ourselves. And what Rollo May was even talking about is how mob violence happens and how gang affiliation happens. People like to lose themselves. And when we were talking about the terrorists, we want to lose ourselves in a cause that's bigger than us.
Wow, that is so powerfully true. And I, listening to the debates and this whole issue of what I hear is one, you know, the different points of view, how it seems like so many of us have gotten caught up in the fear and the pull, the draw that has to identify and to become caught up in this sort of crusade sort of mentality. I think that's a very powerful point. Well, let's see. Well, just remind our listeners again, you're listening to the Men's Talk Show on KVMR here this evening, and our phone numbers are 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867. And our guest this evening is Terry Harmon, and we're talking about nonviolent communication.
I'm wondering if there's anybody in Truckee that is violent that would like to talk about. We'd like to welcome our Truckee people.
Thank you, Todd. Yeah, great point. We're also up in Truckee at 105.1 FM. And if anybody's up there listening tonight and would like to give us a call at 530-265-9555, we'd love to hear from you. I think this topic is huge. I mean, it's so much a part of our lives and struggles. The divorce rates in this country are around 50%. And so often, marriages, intimate relationship breaks down in the face of this very issue of the difficulty that we have in that context, in being able to hear one another, being able to stay connected to our own feelings and needs, and communicate from a place of compassion rather than, I'm right, you're wrong, leave me alone, and which is totally life alienating, as you were saying, Terry, that kind of alienating, negative kind of communication. And I think for most of us, myself included, I think we're sort of brought up on that model, that it is the use of language is kind of about defending oneself and being right. And it goes back, I think, I'm not sure if it was which of the two books here, but one of the authors was talking about Aristotle and the point that, you know, all the way back to the Greeks, which is the source of our civilization, and this notion of self-defense, or making a statement and then responding to the other person's statement, sort of like in the debates the other night. But it is it's a kind of warlike sort of dueling sort of a model.
Did you see War of the Roses with Michael Douglas and wow, that's a film on how to communicate violently.
It is. Yeah,
that's just brutal.
Or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah.
Remember that one? That's an incredible battle. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah,
it'd be an interesting project to look at how violent communication's changed in film over the last 50 years.
Mm. You know, another aspect of this, this has been some time ago now, but we've had a couple of men on the program speaking from programs that help men with violence, and violence in not only physical acting out of violence in terms of verbal abuse and that kind of thing, the Man Alive program. And their models are very powerful and helpful, helping men and women to look at, well, I guess the Man Alive program that I was speaking about was for men, but I think there are similar programs for women in which to help people look at these patterns in their behavior and helping them to begin to understand how they go from that place of thoughtfulness and reason to irrational explosiveness, and really beginning to learn to understand that and manage it more constructively.
One of the things that I find for myself that's really important is that I do take care of myself. I notice that, you know, when I eat more junk food, I tend to be more short-tempered. If I'm not getting enough sleep or exercise and I'm just out of balance with myself, that it also makes it harder for me to find that clear thinking place in my interactions.
Yeah,
it's a great point. It's this whole being compassionate with ourselves. It really starts there.
It's kind of like putting my pants on in the morning, realizing they're a little tighter. That's not necessarily going to promote healthy, compassionate conversation later on. Like, okay, I'm going to have to find a compassionate place here somewhere. And but I'm still kind of thinking about the media and realizing that as a culture, I think our communication has gotten so much more broad and open and visible, and communication is more accessible. We have more ways to communicate now than ever before, and I think we're getting more violent.
I think that's a great question. Are we as a world, as a community of cultures and societies, becoming more violent, or, you know, is that, that's your perception?
That's my perception.
What do you think, Terry? Do you think we're becoming more violent?
Well, you know, I'm reminded of reading a study a long time ago about just the population explosion, and if people don't have the space and quiet that they need, I don't remember, it was some study about animals, and once that you reach over a critical threshold, the whole thing becomes very violent and breaks down. So I could easily see now with mass media, like you're saying, we're getting violent images all the time, and we don't have time to process them. But our body is impacted. We just can't work it through. I had a really amazing experience when I visited Alaska a few years ago. I watched a sled dog demonstration. I was there in the summer, and so they were doing a sled dog demonstration with sleds on rails, and they had, you know, like 30 dogs each chained to their posts in their own little houses, and the dogs were just laying there, no big deal, and then they heard the sled coming, and all of them wanted to go be chosen for the sled ride. And so all of a sudden, in an instant, they went from totally relaxed, lying around, to straining, sounding like they were going to be killed, you know. They were just all wanting, eager to be chosen, and yelping, yelping. They chose the six dogs. The six dogs went off, and instantly the rest of the dogs just lay down and went right back to sleep.
Wow.
I was so amazed at how quickly their physiology went from total relaxation to total adrenaline to total relaxation. And I am aware in my own body, like, how long does it take me once I, you know, get charged up to actually be able to release it in my body?
Yeah. I remember as a kid having times when I was sick, you know, and had to be, it was bedridden for a few days, and how after two or three days I would get to a place where I began to realize that I was slowing down, and my thinking, my whole awareness was becoming much more grounded from just having, and how hard that was. The first day or two was really a struggle. I was just dying to get out and go and do things and play and stuff. But then after a few days, I began to become aware of the world and myself in a from a much more still place, and it was very rich and very wonderful, and I was really grateful that I'd been kind of laid up like that. I've had that experience repeatedly.
Thomas Merton has a quote that I really love, that busyness is a form of violence against the self, and that by busyness we actually, by trying to do too many things, too often, that we actually are sabotaging our very efforts. And he quotes someone who says the Chinese characters for busyness are heart killing.
Oh, gosh, that's profound. And it's so true. I mean, it makes so much sense. It's that whole, you know, I think I couldn't say it more clearly than you just said it. I think that's wonderful.
I know when I was working in the corporate world, my last job was in Silicon Valley, and the corporate motto was better, faster, cheaper. And I remember working 60, 70 hours a week before I just totally burned out.
Wow.
And I remember actually saying, I don't have time to think.
That's frightening, because it is so much of what drives, and it seems like our the pace of life continues to speed up. There's more information being transmitted faster and faster. There's just constant entertainment stimulation. I've actually moved into a home now where I don't have not hooked up to TV. And I've continued to kind of, part of me says, oh, I should do that. You know, it'd be nice to be able to watch this. And then another part says, don't do it. Don't do it. Just leave, kind of just be in that quiet, or put on some music if you want something. Or, you know, I have videos that I can watch if I really want to watch a movie or something. But it's much, requires an intention and a really some. And so up to this point, I haven't, and I'm actually happy with myself that I've resisted that so far. It feels like there is so much speed. It just, and pressure to go faster and faster and accomplish more and more. Seemingly, it's really illusory, but that's what it seems like. Yeah, that's you were in corporate life for 18 years. You said.
Yeah.
Wow. So you really had a big taste of that.
Yes.
Wow. Are you still going through sort of decompression?
You know, it's really interesting. I've been out for about 8 years now, and I left just really burned out. It was quite a trauma for me to just not really be able to go from a high-functioning project manager with worldwide projects to, you know, not functioning very well at all. It was very hard for me. But one of the things in that corporation that really got to me was the performance reward system. You know, even though we had just tons of excellent people, cream of the crop, workaholics that cared so much about what they were doing, they still were forcing us to grade on a curve.
Mm-hmm.
And talking, it was very much a fear-based culture.
Yeah.
And that was very much a part of their performance systems.
Mm.
And it was even years after I left, I was still going, oh my gosh, I have to leave before the next ranking and rating cycle.
Hmm.
Years after I left, I'm still having dreams that I've gone back to work, but I have to make sure I leave before this god-awful nightmare.
Wow.
Boy, that's amazing.
You mentioned rewards-based system, and as Mike and I and Jim were talking about the show on, was that yesterday?
Yeah, Saturday.
Yeah, yesterday. We tossed around the idea that violence is rewarded more in this country than compassion. That was a thought that we threw around for a while, and certainly, you know, just hockey in general, you know, you get more fans drawn for a good fight than you do, you know, the guys shaking hands, or you know, maybe a spouse is rewarded more frequently for being violent in how they communicate and getting their way. I mean, I look at this topic and I think, wow, when is it going to shift, or how is it going to shift? Do you have a comment about that? Violence is more often rewarded in this culture than not?
Well, I guess what comes to my mind right now is, back again to my work in the corporate world, seeing that what got rewarded was short-term results, but that short-term results would really be undercutting long-term results. So it may seem that we get our way in the short term if we're the squeaky wheel or we're louder, but in the long term, we're breaking down relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to work.
But I think we've been violent for a long, 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 long time. I mean, look, you know, you look back at our history, you know, what we did with slaves and what we did with each other during the Civil War.
American Indians,
Native Americans,
uh-huh.
You know, The movie Rabbit Proof Fences, I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I haven't.
It's an incredible movie about this journey of these three sisters that followed what they call the Rabbit Proof Fence in Australia.
Oh, yes, Rabbit Proof Fence. Yes,
yeah.
I did.
Oh, it's a phenomenal movie, but
yeah.
Even there, I mean, it's,
yeah.
You know, it goes back to, you know, showing that our violence has really permeated our, you know, it's just been a part of our human culture, I think. It's been a part of our humanness. And, you know, it's like I get compassion. I think that, you know, by far outweighs violence, but I don't think the rest of our culture is really buying into it. I don't think we're rewarded for compassion.
There's an interesting book, I'm not remembering the authors right now, but it's called The Cultural Creatives.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that actually 25% of our culture worldwide is really shares the values of relationship and sustainability and things like that,
mm-hmm.
but that as a culture, we're, as a subgroup, we're not organized and we're not reflected in the media.
Hmm.
So actually, there is a huge groundswell base out there. It's just that we're not recognizing each other, because what's being reflected in the media is corporate greed values.
Yeah. Joe Piscopo tried to, he was, I don't know, maybe this is partially true, but I know he was trying to create a television show with Oprah that was just all good news. You know, I heard about this about a year and a half. It never took off, of course, but do you think Asian cultures represent a more peaceful dynamic than American culture does?
I don't know.
Well, it's really interesting. I wanted to just remind our listeners that you are listening to KVMR. It's 11:30 here in Nevada City, 89.5 FM and 105.1 FM in Truckee. Thanks again, Todd, for reminding me. And welcome to all you up there in Truckee. Hope you're having a nice night. It's a gorgeous night here in Nevada County. And Terry, we really appreciate your being here with us. I actually was thinking just about this point, that in some ways, another way of thinking about it that's sort of intriguing to me is we look at it in terms of the world and the universe is out there, and that somehow we're the victims of all of this. And I've been thinking recently, Deepak Chopra has an interesting book on wizardry and stuff, and he fascinates. He's kind of a fascinating guy.
He doesn't watch the news either.
No, he probably doesn't. No, he's saying, you know, it's just useful to begin to think of the universe as actually being something that's within us. It's within us. All of this is within us. It's what we're carrying around with us. It's not out there. In some ways, to think of it as out there is to carry this sort of victimhood kind of sense, helplessness, mm-hmm. and fear. And I'm not saying that as a, it's true of me. I feel that at a lot of times, but I also feel, I'm aware that my own, to the extent that I feel peace and experience peace in my life, it doesn't come really from the attainment of those rewards. It really comes from just moments of being, and where I really step out of that whole model, and I know that that's the real truth, but I do think I'm addicted to a significant degree to the pursuit of these goals and the attainment of these rewards. Mm. It's still, even though there's a part of me that says, oh, this is all a silly game, and it's really destructive, and not really life enhancing in the best of ways. But it's very hard to step out of it. I'm speaking my own truth there. It's hard to step out of that, even though I know. And I get up in the morning and meditate for 20 minutes, and I feel stillness and peace and feel, you know, I feel just wonderful. I feel this great, wonderful connection with myself and life. And I just watch all these ideas, these thoughts running through my mind, you know, and I let go of them. I'm not identifying.
Then I get in my car.
Right. Well, I get to talk to people for a living, which I really enjoy. Absolutely. I really do feel passionately about doing that, mm-hmm. and being able to be of service to people. But I still feel like I'm in this squirrel cage kind of system that runs me much more than I would like to admit.
So you're saying that you want to realize that the universe isn't out there.
Yeah.
And all the possibility isn't out there. It's
right.
All right in you.
Yeah, it's in here. And it's like, Terry, you're saying that these... both of these authors and you yourself in teaching and offering this education to people are trying to help us to learn to take responsibility for ourselves at a much more intimate, sort of deeper level, and wake up to what we're doing to ourselves, not only to each other, but to ourselves in continuing to get hooked in these mislabeling of our confusing judgments with feelings, and not listening to what we're feeling and not identifying our needs and, you know, staying connected with ourselves at that level.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of our earlier caller who had the transpersonal and psychology orientation, and I'm thinking of Carl Jung talking about the process of individuation,
mm-hmm.
as being a really important job.
you know, and I think of that. I find a lot of comfort in that, that just me doing my own work and looking at the man in the mirror or the person in the mirror, that that really is rippling out in ways that I probably have no idea.
Mm.
You know, as within, so without.
Mm-hmm. As within, so without.
So that's one of the ways that I do manage my own hope, you know, is that just by doing my work and talking with one person and or letting go of one judgment, that that's making a difference.
Changing the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about how, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I'm curious about your classes or your living compassion, how you approach that. If our listeners might be interested, if they were wanting to, you know, learn more about your, how you approach these classes, is it you know, is it didactic or experiential, or how do you feel like talking about that a little bit?
Sure. What I'm doing right now is having series of 8-week classes, and we just started one last week, as a matter of fact, and it very much depends on the people in the class and what they're interested in. I very much enjoy sharing both of these models because I found so much clarity and more effectiveness in my own life in using them. And by the way, I'd like to say one thing. When Marshall Rosenberg, he's come up with symbols for compassionate communication and life-alienating communication. The symbol for compassionate communication that he chose is a giraffe.
Mm.
And the reason he chose giraffe is that it's the the mammal. It's got the largest heart of any land animal.
Wow.
And it's also really strong. I mean, it's tall, so it can kind of get up above and get a bigger perspective on things. But it's not a wimpy rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, compassionate communication is not about being nice.
Mm. Thank you.
It's about being clear and powerful and effective. Mm. And so in my classes, workshops, I really, they're more like dialogues. And people come in and they've got their own background and spiritual path. They're studying the power of now or Aikido or Byron Katie's work, radical therapy. I really enjoy talking with people just as we're talking on the phone about where are you coming from and what works for you. And how can we use these models just as an initial discipline to help us become clearer in our thinking? So in my classes, I do some teaching, but mostly people are very interested and are already on their own journeys, and they read the book, and then we talk and do exercises and just engage in discussion and practice.
Sounds wonderful.
And I'd also like to share an example. I do mediations.
Mm-hmm.
And I use this model of compassionate communication in my mediations. And on my website, I actually have the whole process spelled out so people can go there and just print it off, livingcompassion.com. But the mediation process, I see my role as supporting each party in getting clear about what they want and being able to speak it. It's very important to us that we be able to speak and be heard, and being able to speak it in a way that the other party is more likely to be able to hear it. Because the minute we hear criticism and judgment, we actually quit listening. So I will support each party in being able to express themselves in a fairly neutral way and being able to understand the other party. And then they come to their own agreements versus going through the court system where you have an external authority imposing a judgment. And I wanted to share an example. I had a couple come to me earlier this year. They were divorced. They'd been divorced for many years, and they wanted to renegotiate a custody agreement for their child. And they had been in a very adversarial relationship with each other. And she was saying, "You're not paying alimony on time," and he's saying, "You're not consulting me." And I mean, you could just imagine the kind of things that happen when people have been divorced and very bitter and a lot of judgments and a lot of court actions. And one of them had been to an introduction to nonviolent communication and then came to me and said, would you be willing to work with us? We have to do this, revise our agreement. And one of the parties was actually coming to the table very reluctantly. But by using this process and starting to walk it through, just in the very first session, they were both able to get down to what they were really wanting. And instead of saying what they wanted in terms of, I want you to pay the child support on time, and I want you to do this, and I want you to quit talking to our child about me this way, instead of phrasing it that way, they were finally able to get down to what they were really wanting. I want my child to know that she will be taken care of and can depend on the support. And I want my child, I want to participate in my child's life. Both of them came to where they could say, truly, we want to give our child an example of healthy, functioning co-parenting. And so by the end of that first session, they both said, can we work with you some more?
That's great, because, I mean, it's totally different than, I want you to be a better mom, or I want you to be a better dad, and you need to, and you'd better, and, yeah, that sounds...
They don't all work that way. The people involved were very committed to their daughter and their own paths, but they also were trapped in this old model of trying to get what they wanted. And so by just having some neutral facilitation and some grounding and compassionate communication, they were literally able to dissolve years and years of judgment and court action, to just really let it fall away and come back to what are their dreams for how they want to raise their child.
Wow, that's beautiful. Must have felt wonderful for you to be a part of creating that.
Well, that's a blessing. I just feel truly honored when I can support people that way.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Nice work.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we're so grateful to you for being on the program tonight and for talking with us and helping us to understand this more clearly. I think it's been tremendously helpful and interesting. We're kind of winding down toward the end, and I'm wondering if there are any areas that we haven't talked about or anything that you'd like to share about all of this that we haven't gotten into.
I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I think we've covered a lot of different things. I really liked what you said, Todd, I think earlier, about a lot of when we're acting out of these places that are not compassionate, that we're really acting out of our wounds.
Absolutely.
That we're really wanting to be seen, wanting to be heard. And Marshall Rosenberg says one of our biggest needs is the need to contribute. And I believe that. And if we can learn to just get out of the way, you know, the way we are conditioned to use language, it gets in the way. Even with my friends who I love and they're on very heartfelt paths, the way we language things sometimes gets in the way.
Absolutely. I do a lot of work around living out of our woundedness. I think a lot of times it's easy to get there and go, I'm going to live from this old wound, or I'm going to live out of this old wound, and I'm going to do everything I can to protect myself like I did when I was first wounded that way, which isn't compassionate to yourself or myself or anybody else for that matter. And so I'm very interested. I'm going to pick this book up and take a look at Rosenberg's work. And it's been a really good show. I've really enjoyed having you on and learned a lot. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Me too. Second the motion.
All in favor.
So when is your next class beginning, Terry? You said you just started an 8-week class, and so if our listeners are interested in when they might contact you or when the next series is going to be starting.
I have an email newsletter list that goes out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually a coordinator for people in the county who are interested in creating practice groups. And so I post events in this. It's a monthly newsletter email that goes out. And it lists practice groups that other people are leading as well, events like Sharon Ellison coming. So that's a wonderful way. People can go to my website and just send me an email, and I'll put them on the email newsletter list. Mm. That would be a good way to stay connected.
That's great. I was just thinking back for, you just said a minute ago, this the whole about the process of individuation, that sort of Jungian notion of, in a way, it's the sort of evolution of ourselves as individuals, as I think of it. And in a way, it seems to me that it just struck me that this notion of a learning to apply what you're sharing with us about nonviolent communication seems to me, in a way, to be a kind of that could be seen as sort of that individuation process as we become more deeply connected to ourselves and learn more and more about how we live our lives and how what comes from the kinds of things we do, some of the violent kinds of things we do, how that serves us, where that takes us, what that's like, and then as we examine that more deeply and begin to become aware, as you're saying, that the violent responses come from our thoughts and the way we're thinking about what's being done or what's happening and our interpretation of that, that's a kind of more subtle level of awareness of oneself. And it does seem like it's a sort of, as we evolve as individuals, that there's this possibility of becoming more deeply attuned in this way. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I also had the pleasure yesterday of attending an all-day workshop locally on the Enneagram.
That's great.
And seeing panels of people from different styles and how they respond to life,
mm-hmm.
and recognizing that for each of us, we have our own way of focusing our attention and trying to get our needs met. When I think about connecting, I think about slowing down. One of you was mentioning earlier about something that was reminding me of my Vision Quest experience, my first Vision Quest, where I really got to just, I couldn't journal, I couldn't walk or hike or read. I just had to sit and be. And I really, just sitting in nature, I felt like I learned how to resonate with the trees and the leaves. And it taught me so much about being still and being in presence. There's a wonderful quote, I don't remember who said it, but one moment of presence is worth 10,000 years of good deeds.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Wow.
But I also wanted to say, in watching this panel yesterday, for me, connecting means slowing down. But that wouldn't be true for all different types. So I don't know what answers would be for other people, and I would want to allow for it looks different for each one of us.
We had Curtis Blair on the program not too long ago, and Curtis is very, very knowledgeable about the Enneagram, and we've talked about that exact point, and it is fascinating, very, very interesting.
I like that slowing down, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, to really identify and reap the rewards of relationship, it's definitely, in my mind, a slower process. It's not not about jumping at 1,000 miles an hour, and it is, I really like what you said, and I think the best moments in a relationship for me have been when things have been slow. And it's been clear and just really aware, and even in my spirituality, you know, you talk about, Mike, you were saying that individuation to self, and then I really pair that with what Terry was saying about something greater than ourselves.
Yes.
So to me, it's I've just enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, me
my
too.
My mind's going. I'm not
getting
slowing down.
No, I got it. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, Terry, thank you so much. We're going to need to wind down here and start to clear out of the studio to make way for Sadashi, who's coming up at midnight. And we've appreciated this very much, and maybe we can get you back on the program again some point down the line and talk more about all this. It's been fascinating.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Terry.
You.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Well, you've been listening to the Men's Talk Show. as Click and Clack would say, well, you've wasted another couple of hours. But I think this was really wonderful.
Yeah.
This was very, very interesting and helpful for me, and clarified this stuff in good ways. And been fun being here with you and tonight, Todd. I think I really appreciated the comments and points you were making and your questions and being here.
Thanks. I know for me, when I get passionate, I have a hard time slowing down. It's like, and when I'm compassionate, I think it's the same thing as, oh, there it is, you know. But I really got a lot out of what Terry shared. And, you know, certainly her insight into the two books was really, really helpful. And hopefully there's somebody out there in our listening audience that maybe had some lights come on and go, wow, that's really good material. I need to take a look at this. And, you know, move forward.
Definitely.
And grow.
Definitely.
And change and make different choices.
I would agree. And just to remind you, if you're interested in getting a hold of Terry and learning more about Living Compassion, her email site is www.livingcompassion.com. Been fun being here with you tonight, everybody, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks. Look forward to being with you then.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Todd.